Welcome to Words of Prey, which is a Pipeline Artists original podcast. You can reach us at podcasts, plural, at pipelineartists.com and find us at pipelineartists.com/listen. So nothing has worked. The microphone has fallen on my head 4 times, so I am now currently concussed.
Oh, God.
So basically, you know, I pulled out all of the podcasting equipment that I hadn't touched since before the pandemic and set it all up, only to discover that the adapter that makes all of it work with the laptop has mysteriously disappeared. I don't know where it would go because the last time I used it was right here in this spot and it all was here. So I've gone through, you know, drawers that are not touched in 10 years. I got ladders and went into closets and have had more things fall on my head in the last hour than I have in probably a year. We are doing this Joe's Basement podcast way. In that I have hooked my headset to the laptop and we're hoping this is going to sound good to somebody.
Well, it doesn't sound weird on this end. Do I sound normal?
Well, I mean, that's relative.
Do I sound normal now?
You sound like you're in the other room watching me.
So, hi, have you checked the children?
So we'll see how this goes. And if this sounds great, you know, we're worth listening to, I think, even if the audio isn't super high quality. But I just feel bad because I would like to, you know, use all of the best equipment on you. And unfortunately, it's just not the day for that. So
it's that's the story of my goddamn life.
I mean, it's life is kind of becoming a joke at this point, isn't it? I mean, I had to explain, you know, I work in publishing and there's a big problem because we're out of paper. I mean, this is a joke, right?
Who did you have to explain this to?
A lot of people. Because, you know, so there's not a lot of paper. Because the people who were manufacturing the paper, you know, COVID, and then the places that had the paper to print the books on, well, they closed because, you know, kind of COVID. And if we actually get the book produced and to the warehouse, it doesn't get shipped out of the warehouse because there's no one in the warehouse because
COVID.
Yep.
No, that's not true. We don't have paper because, Stephen King and Michael Crichton used it all.
Well, Michael Crichton can. Well, I mean, if he comes back from the grave, okay, well, I would like
his books, estate.
I suppose, you know, Pirate Latitudes was not the best. You know, his last few really didn't resonate with me, but still, you know, Jurassic Park, Congo, Sphere, Andromeda Strain. I will never not love those books.
This is the absolute truth of Michael Crichton for me. The mere idea of Jurassic is enough to have, he's got a pass for anything.
Right?
Just the idea. I mean, and it's well written and everything else, but the idea, you will go, that's fucking brilliant.
I know. And I mean, we're smart enough now, especially now that we've gone through, you know, most of this pandemic. And it's like, yeah, we probably shouldn't make dinosaurs. But I mean, come on. If we could, we're totally making dinosaurs.
Oh, we would do. Oh, yeah. Right.
There's no question.
It might destroy the planet, but it might not.
Yeah, I know. I mean, could it get worse? At least there'd be dinosaurs.
Instead of ruining the planet, what we're doing is we're just going backwards.
Exactly. Oh my God. Did you see that thing on Twitter the other day that was like, it started with, we are now closer to to 2050 than we are to 1970, something like this. It was a, you know, can you believe that this is actually, you know, 2050, which was always this, you know, futuristic, you know, there will be flying cars where the Jetsons is actually closer in time to where we currently are in 2021, you know, than that.
That's fucked up.
Right. And, you know, I totally just listened to whatever music from 1970, like today, didn't think about this and it was scary. But then somebody made a comment that the Stegosaurus is closer in time to us than it is to the T-Rex. And I was like, well, that puts everything into perspective.
In mountain time, we aren't even here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The one that got me early was, I remember 1984 coming.
Like the book or the year?
The year. Me. But I remember because David Bowie had a song by that, and there was a book about that. And I thought, well, this isn't anything like any of that.
I know. It's so disappointing, right?
Right. And flying cars is all well and good, and you know, robot maids is all well and good. What they didn't tell us is we're going to do it in capitalism, which means you ain't going to have no food because you ain't got a job. Well, we gave your job to a robot. Oh, but we have no idea what to do with you, so I hope you die.
Well, and there haven't truly been that many advancements as far as, you know, what we thought, like the robotic home and everything. If you ever go back and watch them, I mean, there are a bunch of movies like this, and actually just look at any like World's Fair, but there's a movie with Doris Day, I think it was Rod Taylor, but I'm not sure, called Glass Bottom Boat. And he worked for NASA in the movie. And he had a smart house. And I like know. He had a Roomba, and he had like the entire house was wired to, you know, everything. And they basically had demonstrations of these things in like home expos, world's fairs, everything. And so we're so excited that now we've got like Amazon and Apple smart house. And I'm like, really? That hasn't changed since like the 50s, 60s? We had that.
Don't you have a better idea since then?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, it's one of the things that I absolutely love about books, okay? And whatever form we read them in, but the written word is it's pretty much the same thing as it's always been. And it delivers the most information per bit of anything.
Oh, absolutely.
These little teeny files, I can send you a file that is an entire world I built.
Right? No, that's
cool.
Well, and I mean, it's before we had the internet, which I think is as much a detriment as it is a boon. But I'm a Luddite and would prefer carrier pigeons and, you know, just living alone in a cave somewhere. But, you know, it was generally.
I was with you till the cave.
It's a really nice cave. Okay. But, you know, I think that we learned a lot. I mean, I know a lot of people who are educated only from books, and that can be a better education than a lot of very, very expensive educations. You can live any life, experience any world, any country, many cultures. And, you know, it's a large, I mean, books that I read as a child were formative to me.
Yeah, no, I quite a while ago, I chimed in on there was a writer doing a whole bunch of different essays on, do you need an MFA to be a writer? And I chimed in on the side of, well, I never went to college, so.
Yeah.
And, you know, New York Times bestseller Tad Williams dropped out of Berkeley the first year. Charlie Houston studied theater. Mm-hmm. No MFA.
Yeah. I mean,
the list goes on, but that's about, are you willing to be self-taught? And if you're willing to be self-taught, it's a lot more work, but you get a deeper education.
Well, you know, a friend of mine who I wish would write more books, and if you haven't read them, you ought to. His name is Will Lavender. And he wrote a couple of books that I can only describe as the Westing Game for adults. I mean, they're very puzzle oriented and it's just, they're super clever books. But he had a list of, I think, like 7 habits of really effective writers. And basically all of them were read. If you want to write, read. The best thing that, and he said, you know, he did an MFA and he said, you know, it didn't And it depends on the program and the people who are teaching. And we can get into that momentarily, which I'm sure I will, because it's a soapbox that I love. But he did the MFA and he said, you know, I still wasn't a writer. It didn't do what I thought it was going to do for me. So he said, here's where I got my education. I went to the bookstore. I sat and I read in the, you know, current bestsellers. And then I read things that I never wanted to read or never thought I'd pick up and read. And he said, I learned what I didn't want to do. I learned what worked. I learned what didn't work. And he said, it was all from reading. And I don't think there's any better advice than that.
Yeah. And it's the reason we need libraries.
Oh God. Yes.
It's Jamie Mason. I know there's a bunch, but Jamie Mason and I in particular, were talking about it. We, because we couldn't afford books, we had libraries. Mm-hmm. And that meant you had every book available to you.
Oh, and
that's amazing.
And you know what? And it ends up leading to me having my own participation in the downfall of the planet. But I think that's what led to the fact that if I do research or something, I'm researching for my own book right now, I have to print things out. I have to like highlight and touch them and everything. And I think it's because of libraries. I can recall, you know, anytime now you get a wild hair and you fall down a rabbit hole on the internet, which is of course much easier, but I used to love like getting that same wild hair and having to go to the library and checking out a stack of books bigger than I could carry to learn absolutely everything I wanted to know about a certain topic.
Yeah. It's, both are weirdly, like for me, I love the internet for getting a whole lot of information that I can copy without having to write it down because it takes me so long. And I will usually use a handwriting that I can't read. Mm-hmm. So it makes it easier to be able to copy and paste.
Yeah.
I've got documents on Tricky. I've got piles of them of just things that I copied and things that I copied that I then go back and go, oh yeah. Okay. That's what that's okay. That's how that works. So I'm a fan of both. I must say.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're all great. I mean, I love the fact I'm doing research right now for a book, like I said, and, you know, I can go through and pull all of these articles that I would have to go to a library and pull microfiche that they might not have. And, you know, that could be a 5-year process. And basically I can pull all of these articles in a day.
I'm reading Jay's new book.
Oh, and?
I'm just digging it. It's very, there's things about it that are very of the modern world. That I like. There's a very modern feeling to it.
Okay.
But it's also a lot about memory and a lot about what do we remember, what's real, and what things that I've spent so much of my life thinking about how brains work.
Well, that's a really good segue. And also for the listener, that's Jay Stringer. And I think his website is jstringer.com. Do we know that for sure? Fortunately, I have a computer in front of me and I can tell you.
Don't Tell a Soul is the new book.
All right. I know jstringerbooks.com is the website, and Don't Tell a Soul, which is available, you know, most indies, Amazon, wherever you would like to shop for them. And I highly recommend it, but that's a great, great segue for one of the things that I really wanted to touch base with you on. And I kind of tried to make a few notes of what I was thinking about before we got on this call, but like everything else, my mind is very scattered, and we'll see if we can possibly create a linear diagram of all of this. But one of the things that you and I were talking about last week that I really wanted to pursue, and Jay's a great jumping off point, because when he and I were programming Left Coast Crime, we'll just say in the before times, because honestly, I have no idea what year it was now. But he and our friend Jackie Ben Zachary had this wonderful idea to do a panel on neurodiversity in authors. And so both Jay and yourself and Jackie are dyslexic. Jamie Mason is aphantasia, which is fun to spell and even more fun to say. And actually, I have a couple of authors with Agora who also have that same, I don't want to say issue, because I just think it's more of an interesting way of looking at the world. But it always seems to, and I know, for example, that Jay had a hard time you know, getting into books when he was younger, because it wasn't something that was frequently diagnosed in his childhood, et cetera. And he really got to love words through graphic novels, and obviously loves them so much that he's devoted his life, and rightly so, to them as a writer. But, you know, not everybody is as tenacious and can get discouraged and that sort of thing. And so not only that, on the other hand, you have the fact that all of these people are just floored that somebody who's dyslexic or has any other word challenge can write. And if anything, I think it brings a unique perspective. But what really fascinated me over and above the panel, which I'd still like to talk about, is the fact that you and I were talking about how it's not important as much to focus on the authors with these various, you know.
Yeah.
But the reader.
Different kinds of brains.
Different kinds of brains. Which are all amazing and I think bring different things to the story. But it's important to focus on the potential issues with readers, which Jay has done tremendously well. I know that all of his most recent books have been released in a dyslexic font, which is, I think, a godsend for a lot of people.
For me.
Who've struggled with that. Yeah. But what I, and you also had that, which I'd love to put in the show notes if we can find it again, that podcast or article that you had about aphantasic readers.
It's a woman out of Denmark. It was her explanation of her PhD thesis. And she does mostly gaming, but then she did this, and what it is it is the, it's her area of study is not writing, but on how readers read. And she took one author who is, she says aphantasic. We over here say aphantasic, but aphantasic and hyperphantasic are both real, are both things on either end of the spectrum, like everything else is on a line.
Of course.
And she found two women who were same age, same background, same education, so many things the same, so that they really worked as a good place to do a study to see how does each one of them read differently. And what she found with the woman who was hyperphantasic, meaning she sees things more than real, that she needs visual imagery in the writing when she's reading it, or else she makes it up. Her brain gets bored and makes it up. And she was reading a end of the after the apocalypse kind of movie, I mean book, and she started putting zombies in it, and it really irritated her when she noticed in the book there were no zombies. But what her brain did is there wasn't enough information, so it started to create it. And the woman who's aphantasic and doesn't see images in her mind, she needs less of that. What she really needs is real emotional context. Or something real deep content that talks about emotion that she can actually link into that way. And it led me down this other thought that I've always thought that because I don't read Dickens is one, as a slow reader and a dyslexic, Dickens does nothing for me. If you do a whole chapter on a play setting, it doesn't work for me. But I've read Shakespeare since I was a kid. Because it's all emotion content. There's nothing like that I can get into. And so I realized each one of our brains as a reader, there's a bunch of different ways brains work. And the problem is to get into a good college and to get in for a long time, to get into the big publishing companies and to be the people who are deciding what are the books that are important, you have one kind of brain. And the rest of us are left out going, that's why I loved crime fiction. I loved Raymond Chandler because he's short, fast, pithy books, written very well, but no extra words. And as a dyslexic, no extra words meant something. So I guess that's what I'm thinking about a lot is how do we get writers doing books for the breadth of the people out there reading?
Well, and I think that that's something, you know, I hate to say that, you know, major publishing houses with marketing-centric focuses. I think I've heard that in the long run. It kind of started when publishing adopted, decades ago now, kind of a blockbuster Hollywood model where, everything had to work on the opening weekend. And if it worked, then, you've got to have everything that's like that, or it doesn't work. We just want more of the same thing, more of the thing that's sold. And that ends up, creating more of the same and more of the same and more of the same. And I think that it's important for publishers and editors and agents to find the broad spectrum, which, is what's wonderful about books, is that there's something out there for everybody and people are writing out there for everybody. And so thinking about the fact that, there are all of these readers out there with different kinds of brains, which I completely agree with. And I think it's really interesting because, anyone has preferences. And I think that probably comes down to, how their brain works, what they're processing. I mean, I personally, and this is probably just more of a me problem than a brain issue problem, I can't stand Dickens. I mean, the reason he used so many words is because he was being paid by them. He's not this great literary master. He was a genre writer, which is amazing and wonderful, but most of the quote unquote literary authors that were required to read in, these colleges that were paying so much to attend, were genre writers. And then we're told genre is, a bad thing and poo-poo it. So it's very hypocritical to me. If you love Dickens, that's amazing. And if that inspires you, that's great. It's just not my cup of tea. So I'm completely in your boat on that. But one of the things that I'm wondering if it inspired your writing is the fact that you did come from a movie background, which in a sense I did as well. But you were an editor for that. And so you knew, to edit trailers in order to maximize the appeal and what an audience wanted. And I was wondering if that working in that visual medium and finding the, shall we say, shorthand to get somebody to watch a movie kind of translates it all into what you write and how it is that short, you say Shakespeare and, how it's completely emotive and you understood that and it wasn't pages of description. Elmore Leonard would be a great example of this. He can say more in three words than most writers can in three pages. Prior podcast where I talk about Elmore Leonard constantly. But it's kind of like giving a brief series of visuals.
Oh.
We'll keep that in for sure.
That's just my son. That's Dylan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have to take it? We can always jump off and come back. No. Okay. Also, this thing apparently only has a 40-minute record window. Technically, I should probably do only a 40-minute podcast, but I'm just letting you know in case we have to jump off and back on at some point.
Okay.
So going back to you, did that editing in the fact that you have to give a very short sequence of visuals in order to create a whole picture inform how you wrote after that?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's one of the things about editing and in trailers, but in everything to me in editing is the economy of getting from one thing to the other. And one of the things I hate in books, I hate chapters of people coming in doors and leaving doors. Getting out of the car, walking up to that, all those things that as writers, we learn to go, yeah, you didn't actually need all that. Where's the meat? Come to the meat. Get to the meat of the scene right away. Editing did do that. It was it and Shakespeare and a lot of theater actually taught me structure too. That structure and I get a little, there are stuff in trailers. There are some structural things that I invented. I was sort of at the beginning of some of these wild ideas of how we're going to do this. How can you tell a story differently without a narrator, without in a world, without any of that crap? But how can you tell it And it really is about, in trailers, it was a medium where I got good at, because it was just, how do we get tight? How do we keep this idea? And sometimes getting something to work doesn't mean cutting it fast. It means having the scene work. I learned this about rhythm. What is pace? Pace is information being delivered to our brain. And how it's delivered, a shot can be very short with a lot of quick shots. That's one way. That's a very young way of making pace. A wide shot with a lot of information that doesn't stay up long enough is just irritating, but it also has pace. In novels, we have pace. It's about the information flow. That's what delivers pace. Is there information? Is that emotion flow? All of those things coming at us come together to make something have rhythm and pace. In a trailer, it's all of that. It isn't just fast cutting. That isn't pace, because I've seen those that feel slow because it isn't delivering new information all the time. It's not moving the story forward. At the same time, you're moving emotion forward. At the same time, you're all those. I sound like I'm babbling, and I probably am.
It's okay. A, you know, you're not. But B, that's, again, why we have an editor waving to our editor. But I think that you've brought up a really good point, and something that actually Jay and I used to talk about quite considerably when he was doing a lot of stand-up at the time. And so we were analyzing a lot of joke structure, for lack of a better word, and quickly came to realize the fact that it's the same as crime fiction, really. Like, a really good joke is the same structurally. Because you have this information, you have a twist, and then you have the thing you didn't see coming.
Yeah.
And it's a microcosm of a crime fiction novel is a good joke.
It's, yes. No, it's what the weird thing is, and this is why I suddenly stopped myself, is I realized I can pretend like that's how I work, right? I didn't work that way with trailers either. I would start from the beginning and work till I found the end. And all the things that I did that won awards were ones where I just said, leave me alone. I will find my way to this piece. And I would just organically find my way to the end. Because all the things that I know about structure, all the things that I know about, all the things I've read, all those things are in me, but I can't think about them when I'm writing. So someone will say, how do you plot? Like somebody said about Tricky, God, I never knew where it was turning. How did you plot that? And I go, well, I just wrote it. Half, two thirds of the way through, I remember having a reader who was reading, is my agent. And she said, so is Cisco fooling or not? And I said, I don't know. So I'll keep writing. Because he's either setting this cop up or he's not. And I didn't know. And that's just how I work. And I wish I worked more methodically, because I think it would be maybe less messy, but I think the work might be worse. So I just keep doing what I do.
Well, I think, I mean, obviously I'm biased considering that, you know, I edited Tricky and, you know, put it out through Agora. So there's absolutely no, you know, bias here at all. But if I didn't absolutely love it, and you know, I'll tell the listener exactly what I told you when we talked about it, because I opened this book and I thought it was going to be a standard police procedural with a protagonist who was that cliche, you know, sheriff type cop that, you know, had all of these biases and, you know, just did things his own way. And I've seen this character a million times, only to be in several pages thrown on my head. And not knowing where any of this was going to go, and watching two parallel characters who were growing and changing simultaneously, it was the most unique and emotionally revelative police procedural that I've ever read.
And that's, you know, this. I try and write, I know that we write genre fiction. So I knew that this was something called a police procedural. I know what they are. I've read them. But I don't know how to write a police procedural. I knew how to write about Cisco and I knew how to write about Madsen. So it's a kind of weird thing with me when it gets into genre. It's Young Americans, the heist novel, and halfway through it, the heist was over and I went, oh, fuck. And then I realized, well, there's two kinds of heist novels. There's the heist novel and then there's the getaway. Well, my heist novel had just become the getaway for the second half.
Well, but wait a second. Don't you write noir?
No, I don't.
I'm sorry. I had to.
I have to, though, this is just a quick why, what the difference. Noir, I understand what it is. I kind of get it. I don't know. But I write very romantic novels. If you think of romance, not in the, you know, two people fall in love, but the romantic ideals. Chandler wrote, Hard Boiled is by and large very romantic. That's what I write. It's just nothing noir. By most of my novels turn out, in the end, if you're me, and I came from a very dark background, at the end you go, not, oh, fuck, it just got worse.
Yeah, which is a noir. Yeah. Which is, and for the listener, the inside baseball on this one is the fact that Josh here gets put every conference on the noir panel, despite the fact that he has really never once written a single noir, but seems to present himself as a noir author in some way that we're not sure. And therefore always ends up on this panel.
There are certain things that took a long time for me to, readers and critics liked my early books, but there were a lot of people who worked in colleges and other places who couldn't wrap their head around me. So they had a term for guys like me. And I realized I was on panels. I was called a street writer. And I was talking to another writer who I like a lot. And I went, so what is a street writer? He said, that means you didn't get an MFA and go to college.
Oh, for goodness sake. Well, you know, actually, I'm glad you brought that back up, because one of the things that I wanted to circle back to, one of my authors at Agora, and honestly, I don't remember which one it was, but was on a group panel recently at a bookstore event. And the interviewer made some comment like, well, I understand that all of you have to have MFAs and blah, blah, blah. And one of the authors who didn't was like, okay, everybody on this call, because it was a virtual event, you know, raise your hand if you have an MFA. And none of the like six authors raised their hand.
Yeah.
It's less likely than not. But one of the things that I do want to say, I don't want to say pro MFA, but what I'm watching, and I've taught as, you know, adjunct or guest for a couple of MFA programs, and I'm watching the things that I always hated. I felt like they turned out, as much as MFA programs do not want to be genre, they would turn out generic things in a similar way. You know, it was always very internal, very navel gazing, and very little plot, very little storytelling. And that seemed to be the rule. But I'm noticing a difference. There's a lot more genre, there's a lot more even graphic novel elements to MFA programs. But one of the things that I'm most happy about, and I'm seeing a bunch of, especially in New York programs doing this now, is that they're teaching business of writing, which I think is invaluable.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, you know, you're not going to go in for an operation and not Google what that involves, or, you know, what the organ that they're going to operate on does. And a writer should not just write in a vacuum. They need to know, you know, what happens after they write the end, you know, what distribution is, you know, what an agent can do for you, what these words and these things mean, what royalties are, you know, what earning out means. And just writing in a vacuum is, you know, you can turn out some great work, but if this is going to be your profession, you need to know how it works. And so I'm really thrilled to see that some MFA programs are really turning toward doing that, because it's, you know, practical and street writing, for lack of better word, like to quote you there.
So much of that, I'm always surprised because of coming up in Hollywood and coming up and really having to figure out how to knock out the bills in a bunch of different weird ways. Mm-hmm. I'm very pragmatic about money and business. And I'm pragmatic about, I've watched, there's certain things I've asked you about. If I don't know, I ask. Yeah. Like, what is this? What's the deal with hardcover? And because what I've noticed is there are certain things I know now two writers that I'm friends with who got the big deal, mm-hmm. underline it. And out of the 3-book deal, they got 2 published and the other one, then they were dropped. And then they were known as writers who didn't pay out, who didn't earn back the money that they were given. And that, you don't get forgiven that very easily. That's the one thing that will screw up an acquiring editor's life, is if they have too many writers that they paid and they didn't make the money back. Well, so it's one of those things you'll really have to go, I don't know that I want. I said this to Amy, my agent, when we were starting out. I said, I'm less impressed by a big number than that we make sure it's a number we know we can pay back.
Well, and that's really smart. But also, you know, when I teach, this is something that I often say, because it's like, I'm not telling you to turn down a 6-figure deal. Hell, I'll run with it tomorrow. But you have to know what that means and what the risks are. There are risks and rewards for all of this. And the authors that I know who have done the best and by the best, I mean, they have a long-term career. It's not they did 1 book, they got a big payday, and then you never heard from them again. You know, it's more like you're slowly building an audience. It's, you know, there are always stars in things, but the thing you don't want to be is necessarily, especially in publishing, a one-hit wonder, because that just does not work long-term. You need to, for lack of better example, start in the mailroom and work your way up. You know, you need to, maybe you learn more going with a smaller publisher, an independent publisher. And I just don't say this because, you know, that's who I work with, but I watch people learn how to write, learn how to work with an editor, learn what it's like to market, learn what the market is like, learn how to do events, all of these things, which you don't know on your first book. I mean, it's like, if you want to go to, you know, like a Maxwell Perkins model, or Blanche Knopf, like, it's not, they never acquired somebody for their first book. They acquired somebody for the 3rd book that they hadn't read yet, because they were expecting that author to grow and learn with each book and get better and better and better. You're acquiring potential. And so working with a smaller publisher that you can reach your full potential, and then you jump to a major publisher, and often, you know, even a bigger agent, if you had, you know, a different one to begin with. And, you know, you can bat for the big leagues now, because you really got your teeth on the minors and you know how it is to work with a publisher and an editor and hit a deadline and all of the rest of the things that you didn't understand about the business when you started. So yeah. I always find that those people who have done that route, and there are exceptions to everything. And again, not saying turn down, you know, a 6-figure deal. If that's what's in front of you, I'd probably say take it. But you know, that seems to be the long-term best career.
And part of that is being honest with yourself about where you fit in the market. And that's a hard one to do, is, I think, to be. When I was coming up, I worked for Avco for a while, and Avco had Woody Allen, had a bunch of people, but Woody Allen. And Woody Allen every year got to make, as long as it cost less than $20 million, he got to make Woody Allen's next project. So he delivered movies within that range. Like them, don't like them is unimportant to me. It was the economy of it that made sense. Was they said, we can pay back $20 million. So if you can do it for 20, you can do whatever you want. We won't even read the script. Well, that's because he was aware of he didn't have an ego. He didn't need to make a $100 million movie. He needed to make another movie. He wanted to always be making movies.
Right.
Now, as writers, we have to be clear on who we are in it. We have to know something about the market. Where do we fit in it? Now, I hope I'm wrong some days. I hope I would love to have that breakout hit. Who the hell wouldn't, right? But being kind of clear about where you fit in it helps. The ego will jump in and say, I'm the best ever. Because to be a writer, you need an ego. Just to sit down and look at an empty page and say, I'm going to build a whole world here. It takes a certain amount of ego. And that ego can also then take over when it comes to what you're going to do with the book. And that's where you have to be, I think, have good counsel. Have people you trust around you. You can say, hey, does this seem like a big breakout book, or am I just snowing myself?
Well, and you know, I think that as long as you're okay talking about it, this is something that I think is wonderful about Tricky and your previous career that other people can hopefully, you know, take a page from. You, I see so many really talented writers who do the same thing. They turn out the same book in, you know, a different color, for lack of better description, over and over, and go, you know, why is it not taking off? Why am I not being picked up? Why am I not in a, you know, airport?
Right.
And the thing is, they're doing the same, you know, it's the definition of insanity. You know, do the same thing over and over and assume you're going to get a different outcome.
Yeah.
You haven't done that. And you know, you tried a few things, and this is exactly what I mean about, you know, each book, your next book should always be your best book. And that doesn't mean that your last book wasn't great. I mean, Tricky is always going to be a great book, but I have a feeling your next book is going to blow that out of the water simply because, you know, I watched you do certain things before and then you pivoted. And it wasn't because you had to do something to get picked up. It was because you wanted to change and advance your craft. And also, which we haven't discussed that I just always want to drop in, you know, you wanted to discuss a level of neurodiversity and things like smart teams that, you know, would be great for the world in general. And your next book is something completely different as well. So always reaching, always changing, always growing.
It is a recipe for disaster, by the way.
It's not.
I would say Charlie Houston, if people haven't read him, is I think one of the best guys writing in crime fiction. Who's not writing anymore? He's doing TV, but he did 3 books in his first series. And then he did a lot of books that the ones that mattered to him were all, each book was very different. And it was like the publishing houses and the public had a hard time putting a handle on what he was doing because he wouldn't turn out the same book again.
Well, I mean, it's a little different being that, or shall we say, Andy Kaufman-esque, you know, there's a very big difference if wrote, I don't know, Janet Ivanovich as Stephanie Plum, and the next thing that you wanted to do was really hardcore erotica. Yes, I understand.
How did you know? Those are my 2 next projects.
That, you know, that's not how you pivot.
I agree. I think there's, now my belief system on it, if you honestly, is you write the best book that you're interested in writing, and that's what I do. I'm not interested in writing a book I've already written. And I try and make every book better, but I think whether a book breaks out or not is not planable by me. I think that's the lottery effect, that certain things line up, timing lines up. You're sitting and have an idea and you're 4 years or 3 years or 2 years away from it ever seeing the light of day. You don't know what the world's going to be doing. There's no way to know. There's Ted Lasso, this big breakout show that everyone go, oh, it's so obvious. Of course that was going to be a big hit. It's a big hit because we needed it right now. We needed something very sincere, which we don't often want. We needed something about people who were funny and also honest, but was also really lovely. It's what we need right now in the world. Well, that has a lot to do with we all were stuck at home.
Well, yeah. And you know, honestly, I'm watching this industry where I was literally talking to my boss today about the fact that, you know, we kind of thought we'd gotten through. We survived the pandemic. Well, pandemic is still ongoing, but as you know, a company, like, we lost no authors, thank God. We lost no family, thank God. You know, right. Everybody's vaccinated, we're good. You know, it's that part of that is mostly over. And we dealt with having to go virtual. We dealt with having all of these other issues. And in some instances, it actually ended up being a weird positive. For example, you know, I have authors in India, in Croatia, in other countries, and these were authors that I could have never gotten in front of an audience in the US, you know, a book club, an event, et cetera, because bookstores were very, you know, in-person centric. And if you're not there, it didn't count. But with this time and things being virtual, these people were able to get audiences that they wouldn't have had before. So the fact that we got through all of that and slightly well, only to have the fact that we have no paper and we have no people in the warehouses, I was like, we did not see this coming. Like, you know, yeah. it was an interesting thing to go through. But, you know, you see what, and Hollywood is definitely the same way. I always think about, and some of our listeners, most of them probably are too young to remember, but I remember the year that Tombstone and Wyatt Earp came out. You know, how often is there anything written about Wyatt Earp and the OK Corral and the fact that two movies went into production, you know, independently in that year? These things happen. And that goes back to your, well, it's just kind of luck thing, because yeah. You just never know. And you don't know which one of those two is going to be the one that's going to make it or not.
The lottery thing is, for me, and this is what I would say to any young writers when they ask, the few that ask me questions, I say, you haven't bought a ticket till you wrote a damn good book, because readers aren't stupid. Now, they may not like my flavor, or they may like another, but they aren't stupid. Readers are smart. So you have to first write a damn good book, and all that gets you, now, it doesn't get you fame, it doesn't get you money, it gets you a lottery ticket. Maybe, you know? So you have to write a good book and then hope. Maybe sometimes, I've been lucky in the... There's a lot of, for a long time, I was a writer's writer. There's a lot of writers who know me and like my work. And then I started going, I'd like to be a reader's writer.
good plan.
I just feel like writers are broke and I have to give them the damn books.
You know? Yep.
But first you've got to write a good book. And then it's all about timing and things you can't control, you know? And we are in a beautiful bunch of great writers right now. There's so many good books out. I think these are good days for readers. It means as a writer, you better raise your game. If it's not working or you aren't happy, then raise your game.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And you always have to try to do, you know, better than the last thing, different from the last thing, you know, but the key, and at the end of the day, you have to write what you're passionate about.
Yeah.
And that's really what's going to end up resonating with readers, I think.
Absolutely. I think there is, if I don't love an idea, it's this thing I was just laughing about, because somebody that, another writer that I love a lot, was reading a manuscript I'm just finishing up, and he said, this character needs its own book. And then he had laid out all the things I could do with it. And I said, you sound like every other reader. I'm glad I wrote a character you love enough to tell me what I should do with it, but I have to live with it for the next 2 years.
Yep.
I've really got to fall in love with it.
No, that's really true. And that's why I think it has to be as challenging for the writer as it is for the reader. You know, you have to be as intrigued and figure out what it's going to do next and how to do that and how to get them where you want them to go. As much as the reader wants to, you know, find out what that next step is. And I think that a lot of people don't realize, and kind of going back to the beginning, which I wish we had explored more a bit, you know, I see that we're coming up on time, alas. But I think that it's such a, it's undervalued the fact that a book is a collaborative process. I mean, a film completely is, because the writer has, 100th of input into what the final project is. I mean, it's up to the actors to emote. It's up to the set designers to figure out what that world looks like. Like, there is very little control from the writer. But the writer has to kind of, with a book, I always think about it like writing or creating a coloring book. You kind of have to have that basic storyline with the outlines, and then you have to hand the reader the crayons to fill in all of those things, because you don't want to put all of those things on the page, or else you're taking the crayons away from the writer.
Yeah, no, it's this weird combination of, I agree, for me, it's the least you can say. It's the least you can say and still give them a complete story, and they can then fill in all those other pieces. But it's also collaborative, because there's all these people that you work with that you hopefully love and trust, who will say, yeah, this part, I know what you're trying to say. You didn't say it. Go back and rewrite it. So there's that part that's also collaborative. I don't know any writer that's great who shat out a manuscript and then it was published. It takes this whole village to make a book good, because you need other heads involved, for me.
Yeah, that's a pretty rare writer that can do that.
Yeah. And I wanted to say, okay, this I wanted to say before we get out of here. One of the ways that I convinced myself that I could write crime fiction is I went back and read, there's a couple writers I love a lot, James Crumley, James Lee Burke, both who used to teach it in Missoula. Anyway, non-point. I went back and read their early books, because their later books, I thought I could never write this good. I'm not even going to try. And I read the early books and I thought I could write as good as their early books, because they're not that great. They're good, but they're not brilliant. And going back and reading writers that you loved early work helps you see that they had to do some work to get where they got to when you fell in love with them. That makes any sense, but
it does. No, it just goes that, you know, it's so many people treat writing and publishing, and also, you know, in a different context, making movies in Hollywood, with this kind of golden magical lens that they see it through. And, you know, you have to have a certain pen and a certain soundtrack, and you're facing a certain direction in order to write this masterpiece that you will churn out, and then it will be, you know, six figures, and you will be in bookstores and airports and all of this. And it's this magical thing that doesn't really have any practical components to it. But just like anything else, you have to work at it. And that doesn't mean getting an MFA. That doesn't mean, you know, any of these other things. It means you have to write, you have to read, you have to evolve.
Yeah. There's the biggest thing in that for me is the last part. If you aren't evolving as a human, your work will be stagnant. And I love Tad Williams writes these big, giant, the single book in his series is 1700 pages. So he's going to be on a book for 7 years. And he said, I always have to give myself a whole lot of leeway, because I'm a different person when I'm writing the second volume, third volume, and fourth volume. If I'm not a different person, I'm not growing. The world isn't changing me. So he said, I have to give myself all this wiggle room to grow. And I thought, yeah, we all do as writers have to give ourselves room to grow. Because if we don't grow as humans, our books won't grow. Our worldview has to grow with us.
I think that's wonderful advice. Now, let the listeners know where to find you online and what your latest or upcoming thing is, so that we can plug all of that.
You can, Josh Stallings. I'm at joshstallings.com. I'm Josh Stallings on Twitter. I'm Josh Stallings. I live really out loud. And tricky is really what's out there right now that's important. And everybody has to read it, because people, it's important to me.
I completely agree with that and would endorse that. And I am biased, but I really do mean it too. So pick this up. It is a tour de force, and it is something that nobody else other than Josh could possibly ever write. And it's just wonderful. So I encourage everybody to pick that up and watch what's coming next from his space. And I thank you so much for being on with me tonight. And, you know, despite my apparent concussion.
thank you. Even though you're seeing double, you still dialed my number correctly.
Well, we'll have to do this again, or at least I'm just going to do it surreptitiously next time we chat anyway. Okay. All right. You have a great night, and thank you again for spending the time.
Of course.
Bye. Okay. Great job. Bye.
Words of Prey, and it is a Pipeline Artists original. And Pipeline Artists focuses on education, empowerment, and elevating authentic voices in film publishing and beyond. And you can contact us and the other future podcasts at podcasts, plural, at pipelineartists.com. And you can find us and a bunch of other amazing podcasts at pipelineartist.com/listen. And if you have any suggestions for guests or anything else, or any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out, and we will see you next time.